This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
We all have bad stories to tell about being a model, and so I'm going to begin with my bad family story about being a model. My father took a picture of my sister every day for the first 2 years of her life, mounting the shots in overlapping columns like primitive flip books that mimicked her early development. It was a loving gesture, no doubt, but evidently my sister did not take it that way. Enraged at having to hold still for the camera every day, she expressed her infant pique in no uncertain terms, and my mother eventually did the adult equivalent, irked at having to drop her work every day to immobilize her daughter for the camera. By the time I came along 5 years later, the daily photo shoot had mercifully been suspended. Yet still, I've had to freeze enough times before lenses that the attention of cameras always fills me with unease. And the odd images that look back at me tend to confirm my misgivings. Who is she? Who is this person? To be a model is to give rise to images that have the power, as Vladimir Nabokov put it, to eclipse the prototype. You take a gamble in posing. The image you that results may or not be the you that you want to be. Yet in contemporary life, we've become compulsive gamblers in this way. Never before have people and events been so instantly swept up into images as in our media-pervaded times. Facebook, personal websites, blogs, avatars, we're constantly throwing up images of ourselves for other people to examine and for ourselves to try to believe in. And never before have people so eagerly embraced their virtual nature in this way. Appalled at what she saw as the dehumanization involved in modeling like this, Susan Sontag rewrote Descartes and Berkeley, claiming that nowadays to live is also to pose. That's a quotation. At the same time that we get this kind of negative view of modeling, vast numbers of contemporary artists are at work, artists, filmmakers, literary figures, and so on, discovering a potential for ethical engagement, for empathy, and for equality even, in the symbol of the model. So here's just one of any number of works that you could cite. This is Thomas Strutz, one of the huge photographs in his series, Audience, in which he goes into art museums all over the world and photographs people looking at works of art, the audiences for works of art. And so they become the models for yet another work of art, which is his work of art. And this sort of creation of relays of audiences turning into models, turning into audiences, turning into models, turning into works of art, and so on, creating this fluidity between those who look at art, those who become artworks, those who are models for it, those who are formally beautiful like works of art, and so on. All these distinctions get elided in these works, and there are many, many, many artists examining these kinds of issues today. So for though somebody like Susan Sontag would pose the issue of posing and modeling as a kind of archetype of dehumanization and disengagement from ethical principles and so on, ethical engagement, we get a very different view of the possibility of modeling, for example, in a novel by Christopher Brahm. Many of you will have seen the movie called Gods and Monsters that was made from this this novel. The novel was published first as Father of Frankenstein, and then after the successful movie came out, the title was changed to the movie title, which is Gods and Monsters. So this is just one of many kind of literary treatments of this idea of modeling. And here I'm going to read from my book, since this is a book reading. So in this novel, the protagonist, James Whale, poses for a fellow art student. Quote, "What I don't like is I sit and you draw," he says. "Not fair, John, not democratic." So John undresses too, and both men pose and draw each other. Whale is relieved, says Bram, pleased. They have corrected the balance of things, made themselves equals. One of the joys of art is that it introduces a new hierarchy into the world, unquote. So this rebalancing in the novel is short-lived, but it continues as a cherished aspiration throughout. We might formulate it as follows. To live is to communicate, rather than to pose is also to live. To live is to communicate, and its goals are the democratic values of equality and empathy. Since it's not an exaggeration to say that the introduction of new hierarchies into the world in gender, race, and even in the understanding of artistic experience has been a defining imperative in the arts for the last few decades, the symbolic importance of modeling as a symbol is hard to overestimate. Thus, we could see Sontag and Bram as emblems of two conflicting trains of thought about the meaning of modeling. For those like Sontag, the model represents all that stands in the way of empathy and fellow feeling, a solipsistic absorption in surface and self, epitomized in the makeover mantra, change your image, change your life. This kind of change is just a consumerist mystification, with image standing in for personhood and narcissism for self-realization. But for those like Bram, modeling is an interaction among parties involved in artistic creation and communication. The model and artist affect each other and come to a new understanding of themselves in this process, and viewers respond to and perhaps even emulate the interaction that is thus encoded in the work. These connections exceed the limited sphere of artistic experience. I'll go on reading from there in just a minute. So I wrote with these two sort of contradictory notions of what modeling might be about and the observation that artists in a number of different media seemed to be quite obsessively working through the issues connected with modeling, I wrote The Real Real Thing to explore this figure of the model. Which I see as an embodiment of the uncomfortable duality that we all feel in negotiating our real and virtual identities at the moment. What is a model? This, of course, is the great question. And it's sort of like asking, what is a sign? I mean, everything is a sign. Everything ultimately is capable of being a model. So all I can do is sort of, and especially in these 5 minutes that I have before me, is touch on a few of the ways that I thought we might look at this as a problem. So Genesis. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. This is the King James translation, of course, but it's congenial for my purposes in that it is structured, and I checked with somebody in religious studies who told me that so is the Hebrew original of this. It's structured as a mirror image. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him, and you can break it down, and I do in this book in exhaustive and boring detail into all the different kinds of mirrorings that go on in this. God, sort of comes down to us in the Judeo-Christian tradition as the first model, that man is made in the image of God, and that is what it means to be a model, to be modeled on someone. And this modeling is structured in the very syntax of the of Genesis as a mirroring. When Michelangelo painted the creation of Adam on the Sistine Chapel ceiling, he actually structures it as a kind of mirroring situation, although it's not a perfect mirroring, to be sure. But, you know, you can imagine the point of touch between the famous point of touch between the two fingers as the kind of points of contact at the pane of a mirror, with these figures sort of flaring back from it in this way. And in the book, I demonstrate that the creation of Eve is not structured in this way at all. When it comes to stories of the creation of women, models, I mean, no self-respecting god wants to be the model for a woman. And so all the stories about the creation of women are problematic in terms of modeling. But that's a long, long story that the book goes into. So if we jump into our own time. This is a work of art that whose artist was one of the speakers at the Penn Humanities Forum last year, Orrin Katz. And this is one of the works that he created, which when I saw this in New York at MoMA, I just couldn't believe. It's made of stem cells, and they grow. This is not some kind of Frankensteinian representation. This is a real Frankensteinian scientific endeavor. Though that little coat in the test tube incubator thing is made of stem cells, and they are made to grow in the shape of a coat. So that here you get, and this is a living creature. I mean, or it's a living set of cells in any case. What happened in the exhibition was that it gradually grew and grew and grew to the point where one of its sleeves fell off and it started to clog up the incubator, and so the curator killed it. She killed this work of art. So here, you know, when you get into the situation of art as a representation or a virtual rendering of the real, here you get art creating a reel that is that mimics artificial things like coats, and he does other shapes of things that and produces living things out of them. We are living in a time when technology, not only on the internet, but technology in laboratories, can shift the relationship, reverse the relationship, and problematize the relationship between the natural, which is another understanding of the real, and the artificial or the artistic. In ways that Mary Shelley dreamed of, but that we always assumed would remain fictional no matter what. So you know, these kinds of wild artistic experiments in our time are other ways in which the idea of modeling, what is modeled on what, and what is the reality status versus the virtuality status of the representation. These terms become very problematic. So here is a work in which things, this is the way we sort of think about what modeling is about, right? You get a model, an artist gets a model, and he makes a work of art, and the work of art is like the model. It's exactly as much as you can possibly make the work of art be like that model, except that it doesn't live and breathe. Unless you're Orrin Katz, in which case all bets are off, right? But we just don't live in an age when this kind of idea of mere copying and everything stays in its place. This is the real. This is the virtual. They look alike. There's a mirroring involved, but don't worry about it. Can hold. So I began to think about what goes on in a work of art when it comes to the factors that the work of art is mobilizing for our attention. And Jim said that, you know, he would be interested in talking about the relationship between these later books of mine and the very beginnings of my talk. And I suppose one answer to that would be that I think I've been in an ongoing conversation throughout my life as an academic with modernism. Which I first accepted lock, stock, and barrel as a kind of doctrine that was in disputably the best that art could be, the most interesting way that art could be, the essence of what art could be. And I've been revolting against that ever since. You know, came to a certain point where I pushed that as far as I could, and then I've been revolting against it ever since. Now, what modernism tended to value, and I will come to this, what modernism tended to value is what set a work of art apart from anything else, what made it what it was as art as opposed to anything else in life. And so it tended to validate and value the formal properties of the work of art. What I have here is artwork, which is to say simply the artwork as an art thing. That is where its focus came to be. And worrying about who made it, the biography of the artist. Who cares about the biography of the artist, right? How it would be received by audiences. They're all wrong anyway. They're a bunch of bourgeois idiots, right? I mean, nobody can truly understand art. Forget that. The conditions, the transmission conditions for works of art, like the things that get studied in the history of the book and things like that, who cares about that, and so on. And certainly what it refers to in reality, I mean, that is the referent and the archetype of the archetypal example of the referent, the model. Why should we care about any of those things? You know, that's you can put anything as subject matter into a work of art. What makes it a work of art is how it differs from the rest of the world. So, and I was brought up in this so strictly, I can't tell you, and I can't tell you how snotty I was when it came to people who valued any of these other things. I mean, what vulgarians, how little they understood of what art was really about. And so I think we've traveled a long way since I was a little kid and was trained this way. And we've gotten to the point where people are tremendously concerned about the contextual issues surrounding the production of any work of art, about the way that it functions in the world and so on, and about the nature of the realities that it sort of brings brings into itself in terms of its representation. And one great symptom of this is the preoccupation in so many of so many art historians at the moment, novelists, memoirists, and so on, with discovering who the models actually were that famous painters used. You know, I mean, not only in my time, in my youth, would it have been considered vulgar and irrelevant to consider the life, the biographical facts of the author, but to care whether he painted this person or that person and whether she was a happy person and grew up in Provence or not, I mean, who cares? She's there only as a kind of pretext to get the guy to produce this work of art. So, in other words, we are, you know, what's involved in this is a huge aesthetic turn, a huge turn of attention in the history of aesthetics, away from a focusing on the literary or the artistic artifact of whatever sort, and a turn away from that toward the much less manageable conditions that go into creation itself and communication itself. And the thing about the figure of the model is that it reminds us over and over again that communication and creation are linked and indissociable aspects of creative of art, that you cannot dissociate the act of creation from the act of communication, that a model is there in the moment of creation. A model is one of the first ones who sees the work of art and therefore is one of its first audiences, that the audiences of works of art do care about who is represented and what it means for that person to be represented and so on. And so the whole process of creation is entailed or entails communication as well. And these are important things for us to remember, I think. So here is a work of high modernist art, we might say Matisse's 3 o'clock sitting. And it's an extremely complicated work, and I don't have time to go into it in detail, but I sort of use it next to Anne Hamilton's installation, Mantle, which is the next one I'm going to show, as a kind of contrast between the notion of modeling, our notion of modeling that was sort of characteristic of modernism and one that's going to be characteristic of what comes afterwards. So here... Matisse shows in the flowered dress one of his favorite models who is sitting in and acting like a painter here. Apparently she was occasionally an amateur painter. And she was a very voluptuous woman, and he represented her that way. But here she turns into this kind of wallpaper, dowdy figure. And the model whom she is painting, it becomes this strange and androgynous creature. I mean, it's very hard to know whether we're looking at a male or a female. It's very hard, too, to consider that if you look in behind the painter here, and what we have is an armoire with a mirror on it, and presumably the back of that model posing is reflected in there, and there she looks like a very, you know, voluptuous nude. But compare that to this figure here. And standing above it all, because is the person painting this this work, who is presumably, you know, whose vantage point is above the whole thing, and who can represent all kinds of things that neither of these characters can see. Underneath the reflection of the model in that mirror is a reflection of the painter model underneath her, and the two of them, their hairlines and so on, are exact replicas of each other. So this is the model contingent, whose gender is a little bit peculiar. We're getting some kind of odd statement here about what it means for women to paint and what it means for them to deal with models and what it means for Matisse to be painting the whole works on top of it. And there are lots of ways of interpreting this, but it, one of the things that it shows us is that the subject of modeling is a highly we would call it politicized, but I mean, probably Jeffrey wouldn't call it that. I mean, more like it involves all kinds of power relationships that that can't be forgotten and that do get mobilized in some of the works that I'm going to be showing you. So here's Anne Hamilton, who this is an installation. That's Anne Hamilton sitting there, and she's sewing something that might very well be the mantle that gives us the title here. Behind her are a bunch of flowers, cut flowers on a long table, and as the installation goes on day after day, the flowers wilt. And it becomes a kind of version of a Vanitas theme from Renaissance painting, and particularly Flemish sorts of painting. And she's engaged in this homely, you know, domestic task of sewing and standing in front of a mirror and so on. It's kind of a reference to a whole lot of earlier works of art. But who is the model in this? I mean, the only model is the artist, and she is present. She hasn't disappeared in order to give rise to a work of art. She is there in order to give rise to a work of art, and we are there, because without us as observers of this, there is no installation and there is no communicative situation set up. So I'm doing the 2-second version of this very long analysis, but there's a completely different structure that's being set up in terms of creativity, communication, and modeling in this work. So I'm just going to read a short passage and then show you 2 final works, and then we'll get to the panel. The Sontag versus Bram opposition that I was talking about, as I said, brings up, or certainly the Bram one does, brings up issues that exceed the realm of pure aesthetic experience. As soon as you begin inquiring into, you know, what the model ate for breakfast that day, even though nothing like that is represented in the work of art, you're outside the realm of the work of art. The model is ultimately that which art represents, a reality with an independent existence outside the work. By focusing on this figure, contemporary art can insist on its relation to the world. A real model interacts with a real artist, and the resulting artwork is perceived by a real audience. Works about modeling thus can signal the reality of the creative and communicative interactions involved in the experience of art, however mediated and virtual these may be at the same time. Such art, focusing on human interactions in the real world, inevitably enters the sphere of ethics, an area that has traditionally been distinguished from aesthetics. A realm of mirrors, of fantasy and feint, the arts have always presented a conundrum in terms of their real-world efficacy. Poetry makes nothing happen, declares W.H. Auden, in a poem that simultaneously derides that claim. True and not true, the assertion of artistic impotence has been a valid defense that I myself have used against censors and Baudelaireizers and bookburners. Do not worry, we assure them. Aesthetics and ethics are separate spheres. What happens in art is not happening in reality, and so it is quite safe to let anything happen in art. The changes that take place through art are changes of mind, and democracies recognize the value of entertaining any and all such virtual revolutions. This position we abandon at our peril, and yet the intrusion of the media into everyday experience has complicated the paradoxes of art since Auden's day. We would hesitate, I think, before saying that television and the internet make nothing happen. And as artists increasingly integrate the media into their work and their work into the media, it becomes harder to think of aesthetics as a sphere utterly distinct from ethics. This ethical ambiguity in art is encoded in the opposition between Sontag's and Bram's notions of the model. Like art, the model is a troubling ontological blur, a real person who becomes artificial in posing and gives rise to a quasi-self in the form of an artistic image. On the one hand, she could represent an ethical impoverishment of the real, or on the other, new possibilities for artistic efficacy. So I just want to show you two works that do use this, the idea of the model, in order to insist on the ethical efficacy potentially in art. So, and they use mirrors in the biggest sort of way. Now, the work of art here, called Breath by Oscar Munoz, is a work that he's Colombian, and this work appeared in an exhibition called The Disappeared, which was an exhibition that traveled through many countries in the world of works of art that were produced in response to the political disappearing of dissidents throughout Central and South America that went on for ages and ages. Thousands and tens of thousands of people were disappeared in this way. This work, in terms of its physical form, is merely that oval polished steel. That's all it is. What you're looking at is a photograph of somebody experiencing this work of art called Breath. And what it is, so if you were to see this without her, it would look like a polished mirror, an oval mirror on the wall, and that's all that you would see. But when she comes near it, her breath clouds the mirror, and engraved in the mirror is a photograph. I mean, it's just incised in the mirror, a photograph that appeared in an obituary for somebody who was disappeared. Even though nobody knows that that person actually died, somebody did an obituary for him when he didn't turn up after a great deal of time. So by perceiving this work, by getting very close to this work, by being alive in front of it and having breath that produces fog, this person causes that image to appear, and thus, in some mediated way at least, overcomes a disappearing that happened beforehand. This work is interactive in every sense of the word. It doesn't function as a work of art unless somebody is literally experiencing it, and at very close quarters as well. It is interactive. It brings about a protest, a symbolic protest to be sure, but a protest that attempts to correct a situation in the world that is wrong. But even more literally than that is this next work, which is called Identity. And this is a reproduction of the pages of the catalog in which it is imaged. So it's exactly this. It's a huge room, and there are temporary walls that snake all the way through it. And throughout these walls are these photographs of a man and a woman and a mirror. And you'll see the mirror. It's hard to see mirrors in the picture because they tend to get filled up with things. But what you're seeing, here's a mirror. Woman, man, mirror, right? And that's what you get all the way through this. What this is, and this was produced by a collective of artists in Buenos Aires, who were commissioned by a group called the Grandmothers of the 5th of May or something like that. And these grandmothers, their children had been disappeared when the woman, they had been disappeared as a man and wife. So they were the mothers or the fathers of either the man or the wife. And the disappearing took place when the wife was pregnant. The two were snatched away, would have been snatched away, and they were kept in captivity until the child was born, and then both parents were killed, and the children were raised by the kidnappers. And the idea was that these people would go through the whole process of gestation, knowing that they would never raise their children, and that those children would be raised under an ideology that they despised. So, I mean, it's unbelievable as a political practice, but hundreds and hundreds of people suffered this. So what this collective did is that it collected whatever photographs it could find of these pairs of men and women and strung them out along these walls, man, woman, mirror, and they put a few tiny, whatever meager facts they could discover about their disappearance below that, and they're really pathetically meager facts. Well, when they first put this up in Buenos Aires, two people who had come to the exhibition and stood in by accident in front of a mirror found a strange resemblance between their mirror reflections and the person who was standing there next to them. Because, and of course you can figure this out, they were the lost children of these people. They were now the same age that their parents had been when they were disappeared. And so the children found these strange sort of correspondences between themselves and these unknown parents. Two people, when that happened, discovered who they were, and they were reunited with their grandmothers who had never known them. And since this artwork has been traveling around, 38 people, as of 2 years ago anyway, 38 people had found themselves. And every time somebody's identity is discovered, the images of their parents and the corresponding mirror, I suppose, are taken out of the exhibition. And the idea is that identity will be fulfilled as a work of art when it no longer exists, when every image is taken out of that because everybody has discovered his or her identity as a result of that. And this is a work of art that has as literal an ethical effect as anything that you can possibly imagine. And it functions through a whole series of characteristics of modeling. The viewer is modeled in the glass. The viewer's reflection as the person himself is modeled, in a sense, it's in the parental image that stands there. Those parental images arose because of the models of the actual people who stood for them. It's a whole sort of series of modelings that takes place, and modelings and mirrorings that take place in this. So, I mean, and artists are exploring all these kinds of things and trying desperately to turn art back into an activity that doesn't have to be coy at all about its functioning, its direct power and functioning within the world. So that's what this is about. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Brandy, for this beautiful presentation that gives a sense of the riches of this book that I like a lot. And to just see from what you were saying, and I hadn't planned to talk about this, but I remember my last visit in Buenos Aires, seeing, and I think it was after this or before, I'm not sure, in the Municipal Museum of Buenos Aires, they had gone on with the idea and provided enormous blank spaces of paper on the walls for people to write their comments, and you had still the photographs of the disappeared and a sort of educational public show that would somehow reveal how divisible this was, this very painful moment. And this is a way of saying that your book engages with many issues from, one might say, the metaphysics of the model with Plato and the divine models to the semiotics of the model and to the pathology of the model. You didn't mention that, but I was interested in your last chapter that quotes this book by Dr. Santel, The Case Against Perfection, in which he discusses issues of the pathology of beauty, of remodeling, of anything that could be called cosmetology, and you connect this skillfully with Hawthorne's story, The Birthmark, in which a husband causes the death of his wife by wanting to eliminate just a little sign, a birthmark that she has on the cheek. As you say, page 91, utopia is a model made real, so is anorexia. And with this, we are indeed in this strange pathology that we hear about every day in the newspapers, models who starve themselves and students who starve themselves to be like models. And indeed, this is where the domination of the image on the body appears very clearly. And I can remember a time when I was in France being vaguely trained as a psychoanalyst working with Dr. Regin, who explained that his first job as a psychoanalyst was to work with plastic surgeons. And his task was to try and distinguish the patients who really wanted to have, for instance, their noses or chins changed, because the theory, and I think it's still valid today, was that if they didn't really want this, then the operation would be a failure and the new nose would fall, as it were. and so we have always this suggestion of a certain cloning, and this is something that I feel every time I go to northern countries like Denmark, Sweden, and everybody looks good, but strangely, eerily identical. Walking in the streets of Copenhagen, I have this vague suspicion that they are not really real, but just clones from one single egg of the arch Norwegian or Danish model. And we have, therefore, this question about beauty according to, say, Poe or Baudelaire, is exactly the opposite of this cloning idea. Baudelaire would say beauty is always weird or bizarre, and Poe would say that. And I'll just like to mention the fact that a few years ago here at Slot, we had an interesting experiment with Braco Dimitrijević, a Serbian artist whose work since the 60s consists in showing what he calls the casual passerby. And it means that he chooses people at random in the street and then takes a picture and blows this picture to enormous proportions and puts it on a wall. By a strange coincidence, it happened that the main person he chose, and I will just name him by his first name, because I think he's still a student at Penn, happened to be one of my students at Penn, an African-American young man, Michael, and who accepted, and then his image was on the building next to Slot for a while, and then Bennett Hall. But then what was interesting were the discussions around this, because nobody would believe that he had been chosen at random, and everybody supposed that he was a model, or that he had been modeling, or that he had the aspiration of being a model. And it created quite a pathology for himself, having then regretted to have been the model for Braco Dimitrijević. And I'll just talk briefly, since this is to go on with your discussion, and this is a book that you don't quote, but I happen to know the author of, a book by Susan Munker, They Still Shoot Models My Age, 1993. I happen to know Susan Munker, who was a top model who had been discovered in New York by Helmut Newton, and then had the misfortune of taking classes in Paris at the American University in Paris, not taught by me, but by a friend of mine, on Joyce, and then became a Joyce scholar. And perhaps because of that, couldn't continue being a top model. And after a while, she married, she had a son, she decided to denounce the world of high fashion model, and that's how she wrote this little memoir, They Still Shoot Models My Age. But before, she did this in Libération and was absolutely scathing about the world of the exploitation and how the glamour was only for the viewer and never for the models. This sends me to, and this is really the main question I want to ask you, Wendy, because I found myself in agreement with the way your book moves from a sort of general mapping out of the question, the problematics, one might say, of the model, to your analysis of particular examples, and to one reference that recurs in your work, to Nicolas Bourriaud, who is somebody I really like, and I brought here his main book on relational aesthetics. And Nicolas Bourriaud is an interesting thinker because I think you, Nicolas Bourriaud, and I would agree that the problem is not so much with modernism, as you mentioned it, but with the question of the postmodern. And Nicolas Bourriaud's main theory is that the postmodern is dead, or the postmodern never really existed. And I think this is what you suggest throughout your book, that there should be something that would not be the postmodern, and here Susan Sontag, for instance, would embody the postmodern, that is, or the idea of Baudrillard, that everything is an image, everything is a simulation, there is no reality, we don't care about reality. Even the Gulf War, in Baudrillard's terms, was a simulation. Nothing really happened, which is perhaps an extreme of the postmodern. And modernism, seen in its, you might say, orthodox Greenbergian formulation. The term that Bourriaud uses is ultra-modern, which was the term he launched in 2009 at the Fourth Tate Triennial, in which he tried to show what his conception of relational aesthetics could become, in fact, and I will not mention all the works, but and I don't think any would have a model as such, but somehow it shows that one should go beyond this dichotomy and try to see how a work of art can interact with the viewer to the point that at times there's no real work of art, or perhaps to the point, and I will end with this, and I don't know whether you would see this as a counterexample or not, but thanks to my students and also to my daughter, I've discovered, who is only 12, Lady Gaga would be a good case in point, where we have somebody who is clearly not really very beautiful or not a great singer, but who has created this blend between the, let's say, older model of Madonna and another generation, but has added to the idea of pop music and being a star, the idea of self-fashioning. And so what she brings to the world of pop music and iconography, iconology, is this idea that anybody, and many of my students are tempted by that, anybody can just play with fashion, with images, and recreate themselves. Do they have a political impact for all that? I'm not sure. This is a question, at least. Thank you. I'll just stop here.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be included here tonight. And it's been a great experience for me to read Wendy's book not just one time, but another time closely in preparation. And I can attest to those of you who haven't read it yet that it really is a wonderful work. If you're someone like myself, not trained with a background in art and aesthetics, it's remarkably accessible, all the while extremely sophisticated and educational. And I've learned a lot from reading it. And I can say also that the specific issue of the model and Wendy's treatment of it is influencing my own work as I start my next book project and thinking about how do we think about citizenship and what should the model be. It's a direct relation that I really owe to her and this work. In the spirit of the interactive aesthetics that she's promoting in the book and that she talked about in her presentation, a type of aesthetics that doesn't aim only to have a notion of beauty, but to engage with the world and change it, and to change it in an ethical direction, I thought I would pose questions to her from three of the alternative traditions that she's in conversation with, classicism, modernism, and postmodernism. And it strikes me that she reserves her harshest treatment for classicists or neoclassicists who believe in perfection as an aesthetic ideal. She says, for us, for those who truly understand, in the 21st century, perfection has lost its charms. And she seems to be opposed as well to an aesthetics that wants to uplift us, take us out of the world. This interactive aesthetics that she's documented and I think is defending wants us rather to engage with the world. And she is critical of classicism for subscribing to timeless aesthetic values. And thinking again in the spirit of interaction, what might a classicist reply? One possibility might be this notion of the ethical that plays a part, seems to play a vital part in this interactive aesthetics. To what degree is it itself a kind of commitment to universal values? The answer might be that it's not, that we can have an engaged art that doesn't make appeal to transcendental metaphysical norms, but it strikes me that some of the examples of using art to combat tyranny or genocide and so on are the types of examples that lend themselves to a type of moral universalism. And so one reply might be, to what extent is interactive aesthetics a type of moral classicism, if not an aesthetic classicism? Thinking about the book from the perspective of modernism and continuing the discussion that's been raised, modernism, as Wendy portrays it, and maybe it's not best exemplified in the Matisse that she showed, wants to get rid of the model, wants to have an art that is without referent, without model, or if there is a model following Walter Pater and later Kandinsky that aspires to the condition of music. And I wonder if that that modernist urge to be free from ethics, to be free from the world, stems only from this bold determination of art for art's sake, or of an art that is all its own, and doesn't also stem from a disenchanted cold belief that the sphere of ethics and the sphere of aesthetics are not only different, but in certain senses opposed to each other. And citing again Baudelaire, Fleur de Mal, Flowers of Evil, a book of poems that invites us to see aesthetic beauty not just in something that is not ethical, but that is unethical, one wonders if a modernist reply would be to at least note the idealism of interactive aesthetics, the idealism that aesthetics and the ethical can be linked together, and perhaps to ask the question whether there are limits to how well aesthetics can engage with ethical issues. Are there certain ethical matters that interactive aesthetics is better able to handle than others? I thought of Rousseau's letter on the theater, where, speaking of the theater in general, but also of Molière, he says that Molière could make fun of vice, the theater could make fun of vice, but could not make virtue loved. That there was a limitation to how well aesthetics could, it was good at putting down things, of opposing things, but less good at celebrating a positive, pure moral virtue. And so, again, the examples of from interactive aesthetics seem to be, not entirely, but in a great deal, opposing things like genocide and tyranny, and in a certain sense, therefore, figuring them and having us relate to evil or relate to oppression. And the question I would have, I guess, again, is, from this modernist perspective, are all sorts of ethical matters fair game for the type of aesthetics that you've so wonderfully uncovered and I think are also defending, or are there are certain limits to what interactive aesthetics is best able to engage with? And then from postmodernism, which does engage with the model, Wendy tells us, but does so with in a spirit of playfulness or irony or above all paradox. She has this wonderful term, the paradoxicalis, as a defining an aesthetic standpoint that notes, for example, the difficulty to separate virtuality and reality, but wants to end there and sort of be dazed and satisfied with that paradox. And she, I think, is close to this perspective, but wants to move beyond it, because interactive aesthetics does not only want to revel in the paradox of the intermeshing of virtuality and reality, but wants to, again, engage in the world and seek to change it in an ethical direction. And I think perhaps the postmodernist might ask, if that is the goal, what differentiates interactive aesthetics from hard-nosed journalism or 60 Minutes that also wants to engage the world in an ethical direction but is not that has no artistic element? What extra work, if any, does the artistry do? Or, in fact, is it a non-instrumental, non-ethical value that is still actually very much at play in the interactive aesthetics? One other point on interaction I would raise is, to me, there seems to be three types of interaction at stake. One is the interaction between virtuality and reality, which we've talked about and that I think seems to be compelling, the sense in which it's harder than ever to separate the two from each other. The second is the relationship between the artist and the model, which I take to be the most important of the claims and wonderfully substantiated. In many ways, artists are becoming models and models are becoming artists. Artists are self-modeling and so on. And it's here that the interactive, egalitarian thrust of interactive aesthetics seems to be most brought to fruition. But then there's the relationship of the artwork to the audience. And I wonder in this third form if we can expect the same level of interaction, the same level of equality, the same level of democracy. It is an interesting feature of all the works that are mentioned is that we still know who the artist is. For all of the paradox, it doesn't seem we're still paradoxical yet that the person of the artist has been effaced or eclipsed. And furthermore, even the interaction that the artists call for are in some degree planned from in a premeditated way. And I suppose it comes down to that same sentence that Wendy quoted, this beautiful idea from Christopher Bram that one of the joys of art is that it introduces a new hierarchy into the world. And that can be read, I suppose, in a more or less egalitarian way. It's more egalitarian when you think of art challenging social and political hierarchies, But if you read it as introducing a new hierarchy, that there still is a hierarchy after all being introduced into the world, one wonders again if in the relationship between the artwork and the audience is as interactive as the artist and the model. One last point I'll say is one of the things that I loved about the book is that it offers what I believe is a new variation of a theme from Andy Warhol. And this is Andy Warhol's idea that in the future everyone will have their 15 minutes of fame. I personally think that's a false prophecy. It's just not true that we're all famous or have our 15 minutes or that celebrity has been neutralized. We can still quite clearly point to those who are very famous and those who are not. But what Wendy says, some wonderful lines, is by the early 21st century, the paradoxes of celebrity define us all. And what I understand her to be saying is not that we've all become celebrities, or many of us, but that we've become like them in having to manage public images like never before. And again, quoting her, she says, increasingly we experience our images as ourselves. And I think that this is very much true. We have the sense that if certain things we do are not covered in the press, it's as if they didn't happen. I myself suffer from this irrational fear that if I don't take pictures film my two young daughters, it's not only that I won't have something to look back on when they're older, but that I haven't been enjoying their childhood, which is really a non sequitur. But I think it's a type of truth that this notion of us engaging with the paradoxes of celebrity very much captures. And I think those of us who find ourselves Googling ourselves and caught up in the narcissism that the new narcissistic possibilities brought in by the new media also can relate to the dilemmas of not becoming exactly celebrities, but becoming like celebrities with the possibilities of self-imaging and the dark side that comes with that too. So there's a lot more to say, of course, but I think I'll just end there. Thank you.
So Jean-Michel brings up Bourriaud and his relational aesthetics, which conceptually I admire enormously. I think it's a very brilliant book. But the examples that he uses are some of the most vapid works of art that of our time. There are these typically these kinds of installations where somebody, the artist, stands in the work of art and offers a glass of tea to somebody who comes by, and they say, oh, that's nice tea, or not, and bye, it was nice to meet you, and off they go. I mean, it's an interaction, but it's so forced, and it's so inconsequential in any way that it becomes like a kind of quotation of an interaction. And his Bourriaud's wonderful theorizing is directed at works of art that are like the kind of bad cases. It seems to me that you can, and that's in a way what I was hoping to do, to take those works and or those ideas and apply them instead to works of art that I respond to very strongly. So it may be just my fault that I don't get much from those kinds of works of art. So after my book was in press, for example, the Guggenheim cleared out everything in the spiral in it and created a work of art in which you would walk in as a visitor and you would be met three times on the way up the spiral. And the first time, in my case anyway, there was a child. The second one was a young man, and the third one was an older woman. And the child engaged me in conversation, I found myself sort of, oh, how cute, what a cute child to be able, and you watch yourself responding all these ways to a very artificial conversation and forced and so on, but nevertheless, you have reactions to a child that you can observe yourself having, and then a young person in that, you're much more aggressive. I mean, it wasn't such a young person. I mean, that was fair game. This was an equal, and you felt certain things, and then there was a much older person, and I found myself responding in all kinds of stereotype ways to, to what that person was doing. And so, I mean, the whole of the Guggenheim was given over to this at the time. That was the work of art, as it were, that was up there. And, you know, they trained a million people to act as these guides on the way up. And people tromp through the thing being guided in this way. Well, it's another of those works. And though I thought a little bit about how I react to people of various different ages, it didn't do all that much to me. And it's another one of those kinds of work. But it doesn't matter. I mean, I think we're going through a period when people are desperately trying to investigate the whole idea of audience participation in works of art and the sharing of the roles and the power relationships involved in the various roles of the characters involved in the creation of a work of art. So the artist, the model, the audience, even the work of art, where everybody can become each of those things in turn and often at the same time, simultaneously in a work of art, so that you're in this strange semiotic situation where you're being many things and representing many things. So in other words, I always sort of back off at a certain point and say, I'm just a reporter. I'm just sort of reporting on the state of art right now, which seems to be very preoccupied with these kinds of relationships. And I think we are preoccupied by these relationships because, you know, as with the introduction of any major new communications technology, the relationships involved in communication in our day, among the parties involved in communication in our day, have been rearranged by the internet, by genetics, by many other factors that exist in our day. We just don't live in the same world in terms of communication and interaction that we engaged in before. And whenever that sort of thing happens, the arts go mad and they start processing. It's like anybody faced with a new circumstance, all you can do if you want to get through it is to figure out what it is, and you obsess over it and obsess over it, and we're getting a lot of different ways of obsessing over this right now. Whether it's for good or for ill sort of thing, I have a certain liberal ideology that I pushed at various intervals, and so that's why I like those particular examples as examples of ethical thinking. But I don't think that the kind of art that I'm talking about necessarily has to push that ideology. You can push all kinds of what we might think of as immoral outcomes in this, and I'm sure a lot of art does do that. I mean, putting people in uncomfortable situations, a lot of artworks are doing that, and forcing them to behave in ways that make them very uncomfortable with themselves and make them maybe regret that they were involved in them before. There's no preordained ethical set of principles that this kind of interactive art is necessarily going to bring about. It's, I think, an investigation of what's involved in interactivity per se. And one of the things that's involved in interactivity is the following. Since every interactive situation in art is a potential model for every other kind of interactive situation, and what happens in an artistic interaction is very observable. You can become very conscious of what's involved in it in a way that in the vast numbers of interactions that we're constantly involved in, it's harder to take note and to understand in a well-formed sort of way. Since we are creatures who understand how to apply models and how to think through models and who benefit very often from models in that they give us patterns that we can replicate, whether they're good patterns or not is another thing. art has an ethical, of this kind of art, has an ethical efficacy, whether it likes it or not, insofar as you perceive the interaction that you're seeing in the aesthetic experience as applicable in the world. By definition, it has an ethical valence in that way. And that is very interesting. Now, this is what conservatives have said about the nature of all artistic experience, that it has direct impact in the world, that you learn from art how to behave, and therefore when art teaches you bad ways of behaving, it's done a disservice to you and to society in general. And the problem there is always, to my mind, that the assumption is that once you learn a model, you can't unlearn it, and you are bound by it, and it's the only model you've got going for you. And so, watch out. You know, don't give people bad models, or you'll get a bad world. I don't think that is necessarily implied, but the potential for the application of anything that stands as a model is certainly there, and we have to, in a way, accept that, I think. And we have to accept the potential that something that goes on in a work of art in terms of an interaction may not be desirable in the world. Classicism, so I mean, I don't think that I can be necessarily gotten in that way in terms of my treatment of classicism. I have a lot of beefs with contemporary dealings with classicism, mainly because it's a kind of totalitarianism in disguise, and I just can't bear it. So you have to read the book to find that out and see how you feel about that. And finally, I wanted to just say an example, and I can't remember. It came up when you were talking about Googling yourself, and I told you beforehand that I have a Google Analytics alert that on my thing, so that anytime a new reference to me or my books comes up on the web, I get a little message, an email that with a website where I can go to, and I'm sure many people here have it too. I'm not the only total egotist in this group. And one of them came up, and it was the most extraordinary thing. Somebody had taken one of my very early books in the section that was on cubism, and had taken the ideas in it and applied it to bird watching. And it was extraordinary. I mean, it was on a blog, and the person had talked about the relation between foreground and background and the ambiguity between it that I talked about in cubism, and described bird watching as a kind of cubist exercise on these grounds. And it was, I think not because it came from me, it was just a brilliant transposition of a set of ideas from one place to another. And it turns out that this, it was written by somebody who lives in New Haven, and he's a retired Yale professor of biology who is 95 years old and spends his days blogging in this way. And I began, it made me really think, what, I mean, that's a real interactive situation. If ever I sent him an email, I couldn't bear not to after that. And it's extraordinary what we have the potential to transmit our ideas in a way that we have never had before, and to get feedback in ways that we never have before, and to build on that feedback and make it go back and forth. It's a very interesting time that we live in that way.